The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Matt Wells, and welcome to your special Easter bank holiday edition of Media Talk. Coming up,
the big games. Every club. A new season on Sky Sports. All the football you'll ever need.
Ofcom tells Sky to cut the price of its sports channels. We analyse the implications for Rupert Murdoch, his customers and his rivals. Also in the podcast,
the net result of this will be to persuade anybody who blogs that they need to follow the same standards as they would as if they were writing for a book or a newspaper.
Spectator editor Fraser Nelson gives his reaction to Rod Liddell's blog falling foul of the PCC. Plus, Claudia Winkleman is confirmed as Jonathan Ross's successor on film 2010. But
good morning, this is Today with Evan Davis and Sarah Montague.
Today programme editor Kerry Thomas says Radio 4's flagship show is no place for a lady. You should feel the pressure on this podcast, love. This is Media Talk from The Guardian. Happy Easter, and to all of our Jewish listeners, a very splendid Passover to you too. Now, your panel today is made up of the Observer's media editor James Robinson and Jane Martinson, who's the editor of Media Guardian, a post I used to fill in a previous life, which begs the question, how many media editors does it take to make a half-decent podcast? Answer on a postcard, please. Anyway, Jane and James, very good to see you both. Jane, you were on holiday straight after this recording, apparently. Jetting off to sunnier climes.
Sicily.
Oh,
I know. It'd be so lovely.
How are you, James? Hot cross buns at home for you this weekend?
Yeah, I'll be heading up to Nottinghamshire because my other half now resides in the East Midlands.
If you read the papers,
yeah. Which I sincerely hope you don't, you may be aware of that fact. So I'll be getting on the East Midlands train service. I wonder, on a Friday night, they do a curry special.
Do they?
Cobra and a curry for a tenner.
Sounds fantastic.
Which I look forward to.
It's a good way to spend your
I don't know if that's available on a Thursday with it being about. Well, we'll soon find out.
Excellent. Well, there we are. I think that's enough. Too much information about James's
travel
plans.
Where are you going? That's what we want to do.
Listen, I want to get. I'm going to the first damn thing in this script. That's what we're doing. I'm not going anywhere because I'm on election duty, of course. Yeah. Anyway, there's plenty to get through today, including Simon Singh's libel victory in the High Court. We'll come to that later. So let's crack on.
We'll begin with a spin, traveling in the world of my creation.
Your TV with a Sky Plus HD box is Super Telly. And now the box is free. Sky, believe in better.
We start with the news that Ofcom has ordered Sky to reduce the amount it charges rival broadcasters who want to show its premium sports and movie channels. As a result, BSkyB will now have to sell Sky Sports 1 and 2 to the likes of Virgin Media and BT for 20% less than the current wholesale price. The decision is part of the media regulator's three-year inquiry into the pay TV market and will have significant implications across the worlds of media, business, sport and politics. James, what's your take on this? Presumably, it's a good thing to break up a monopoly.
Well, I do have a certain amount of sympathy with Sky, actually, because they have spent billions and bet the company on premium rights, especially Premier League football.
It is obviously their business model.
I mean, their entire business model is based on that. But having said that, it is a good thing. But will it really be revolutionary? Will it transform the world of TV sport? Will it lead to vastly cheaper prices for people to watch on competing platforms? I'm not entirely sure that it will.
Everyone is getting, including the sports rights holders themselves, Football League and everyone, are very agitated about it. So they must think that it's significant.
Well, they think it's significant because of the principle that's been set, don't they?
Right.
They think that anything that threatens Sky's dominance of that market is bad news for them because, I mean, I don't think they necessarily believe that there's a direct financial consequence to this in terms of Sky's profits and the amount Sky will pay. But obviously, it's the theory and the principle that others should be given access to Sky's content, which they're frightened of, because there's this unholy alliance in some ways between the sports bodies and Sky, which keeps, you know, effectively, it's ironic when you hear the Premier League and the Football Union, Rugby Football Union, and others, and the ECB saying, you know, effectively, they're saying we want sport to have a smaller audience than it would do if it was on terrestrial TV. You know, it's odd actually as an armchair fan to hear that argument advanced.
Because it's meant that a sort of minority of people within it and players and teams within it have actually done very well, haven't
they? Yes, but it's in their interest to keep it that way, isn't it? Because then that's how you get more money out of it.
Well, I think, what's interesting about this, and you know, Sky is definitely taking the sort of moral, economic high ground, and I too have some sympathy with the argument that if you have spent an enormous amount of the sort of your start-up period investing in these rights, the problem was that was a long time ago, and the market now is very mature, and it is impossible, as has been proven many times over, for any competitor to come in and break into the market.
If you look at the reaction, others have tried.
Lots of people try. The argument is often made that, you know, the NTL cable companies failed because of their own failures. ITV Digital failed because of their own failures. You know, but even the tiny entrants that have tried to be sort of, a version of premium sports on TV, like Top Up.
Satanta, yeah.
The old Top Up.
Skylight, a sort of Skylight.
Yeah. Right. Okay, you cannot get that in this country. I actually think Ofcom has been very brave and I think remarkably savvy with this ruling, because everybody's complaining. Sky's complaining, but also BT, Virgin, they're all complaining too. But actually what they've managed to do is, one, as James says, completely, the precedent here is really important. The principle of intervention in a market that is deemed by many, mostly Sky, to be working is really important.
Will it stick, James? Because Sky have said that they're going to take it to the court.
Well, of course, as they always do, they will run to
the court. Is it the Competition Commission?
The Competition Appeal Tribunal, right, I believe. And they will look for a stay of execution, as it were, so to give them time. You know, while they prepare a full appeal, that they will seek to stay on Ofcom's judgment, so it doesn't come into force immediately. That's the crucial thing.
I see. Now, this will drag on and on, you think?
It will do. And the key question, of course, is whether it will drag on. It looks like it will drag on beyond an election, which then begs the question whether a Tory government, if assuming one is elected, will leave Ofcom intact in its current form, and whether Ofcom will really have the teeth and the power to push this through, you know, post-election. And I think the answer is probably no. I don't know what you think, Jane.
Well, what's interesting about the ruling is that they have managed Ofcom to... I mean, it wasn't as harsh as everybody expected. The share price performance of Sky this week has shown, you know, going up 20 pence since the announcement. It shows that the city was expecting a much harsher judgment. They've also done this, I think, quite clever thing about saying that if you agree with this ruling, we will allow picnic. So this whole idea of allow, which we had in the media section a few weeks ago, about basically the deal is, the Ofcom ruling said to Sky, if you agree with this, we will give, you know, you can go ahead with picnic, which is basically giving them a platform on DTT.
Right. This is allowing them, this is allowing them to put pay TV channels on Freeview, basically.
Yes, yeah. You know, it's quite a clever thing. And I think they must be looking post May the 6th to say, in terms of a judicial appeal, in terms of the CATS, tribunal looking at it, it's quite a balanced argument. You couldn't say... I'm sure Sky are saying this, but it's more difficult to argue this is absolutely ridiculous attack on, an effective provider of a service.
Is it just about the sports rights, or does the movie stuff come into it as well?
It's less contentious, yeah. I mean, and also the whole movie issue is the issue of rights is more complicated and also much more diverse. I mean, it's... sports in this country for Sky. I mean, you know, it's always repeated, but Rupert Murdoch has called premium sports a battering ram for his services around the world, and it is Sky's DNA.
Okay, what about ESPN, who are the sort of new entrants into the sports rights market in Britain? Is this good news for them?
I'm not sure. I think it's fairly neutral for ESPN, isn't it? I mean, I think that one of the points about this ruling is that you will still, if you want to get the majority of sport, you know, football games or sport generally, on your TV, you'll still have to subscribe to multiple sports packages, won't you? I mean, it sounds trivial, but if this ruling affects Sky Sports 1 and 2, there's nothing to stop Sky putting big games on Sky Sports 3 and 4, which aren't going to be cheaper.
Well, that's what BT's main argument, isn't it? Is that they'll simply sort of gerrymander what they can
do. Which is why BT don't think it's gone far enough. So, I mean, the problem is, if you are a sports fanatic, as most, you know, people who sign up to Sky Sports are, you'll need to buy them all. And I'm just not sure that the price will be... I know BT have said they'll not, you know, push the price down from above £20 per month to mid-teens. But I'm not sure that it's going to be a game changer in that sense. I mean, ESPN is one of many channels, you know, so I'm not sure they'll be affected either way, to be honest.
Okay, well, as James was saying, this is just the start of the battle, or rather, it's not. It's sort of the middle of the battle. Yeah. It's been going on forever.
And
it's going to go on for years. Well, you can keep up to date with it as it develops for the next few years at mediaguardian.co.uk. Now, a landmark ruling was handed down by the High Court this week after science writer Simon Singh won his appeal for the right to use fair comment as a defence in a libel action. Singh was sued for libel by the British Chiropractic Association over an opinion piece he wrote in The Guardian in April 2008, in which he questioned the claims of some chiropractors over the treatment of certain childhood conditions like colic and asthma. It's been a long-running and expensive legal battle and something of a cause célèbre amongst the science community. Robert Dugan is Simon Singh's lawyer. We can speak to him now. Robert, you must be thrilled by this ruling.
Well, it's the sort of judgment you hope you'll get, but you imagine you never will. It's absolutely, a 3-0 victory from the most powerful court of appeal that you could ever expect at it. And more than that, it's not only ruled unambiguously in favour of our client, saying that the article has the meaning we always thought it had. But beyond that, there's lots of passages which should give lots of comfort to any scientist who's being sued that the courts are going to interpret what honest scientific debate as comment, not as fact.
So tell us, explain what is the importance of this ruling? What is the significance of it specifically?
Obviously, there are various defences to a libel action. Libel is a rather confused area of law. There's lots of defences to have been set up to deal with specific purposes. One of them, of course, is justification, proving the truth of something. Now, proving the truth of something can just be really, really expensive. Fair comment means that all you have to do is show it was an honest expression of opinion based upon facts of which you are aware. Now, what this case means is that the Court of Appeal have adopted the approach taken by the American courts in Underwager and Salter. A Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in America there said that the place to settle scientific disputes is in the laboratory or in the seminar room. It's not in court. And that's what they've adopted. So that's now the law here.
So what does this ruling mean for libel law more generally? Because there's a lot of controversy about libel law at the moment, and Jack Straw, the Justice Secretary, has announced that it's going to be reviewed.
Well, this isn't the end. We still need more. What this does is say that a scientist who's being threatened because they've indulged in hard-hitting scientific debate has got a good defence. That's not the end of the road for libel law reform. And in fact, the judges in this case were very scathing of the law. They said several times that, well, if this is where the law leads us, we must apply it. That is not a resounding endorsement of the law. This isn't a substitute for libel law reform, but this does have...
It's a signal for how important it is, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Here you've got the judiciary saying that we do need to look at this area of the law. This case isn't a substitute for it. It shows how important it is.
OK, thank you very much. That was Robert Dugan. He's the associate at the Brian Cave LLP, representing Simon Singh. This is good news, Jane, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really good news. I mean, the Simon Singh case was one of the handful of cases that have really been seen to challenge the libel laws in this country, in the way that when it was sort of newspapers saying, well, this is wrong, it's just protecting incredibly wealthy people, there was very little support within Parliament. But as soon as it became scientists in this case trying to argue about scientific fact, or indeed scientists and academics arguing in other countries and criticising companies who were then being sued in this country under the laws of libel.
So it's sued for articles in scientific journals. I mean, it's absurd. Yeah. Okay, there's more on this story at mediaguardian.co.uk. Well, that's Sky and libel dealt with. So on to some of the other stories from media land this week. Jane, there's no denying it. You are a woman. What do you think? Do you think you could cope with presenting the Today programme? Because Kerry Thomas
am so furious about these comments by Kerry Thomas. I mean, you know, there's The really interesting thing about this, I think, is that there's so much that's been said over the past few years about, you know, by Anna Ford and many others about Moira Stewart, about how women, you know, you can't age on camera. But here we're talking about a radio program where women are somehow being equated to being a rookie, soft interviewer.
Yeah, he and said, he was on Radio 4's Feedback, wasn't he? Talking about, he'd been asked about women presenters and why there was only Sarah Montague on the stage program, and he said that it was a tough environment.
Yeah, and of course the suggestion, which I know is, there's a sort of sense that he didn't quite mean it like that, but, you know, the suggestion that somehow women can't hack it in those sorts of tough environments. You know, you can't be a rookie. And I know he said doesn't mean, he meant that there aren't enough people who've been around the block. But I'm sorry, I mean, you know, Evan Davis, 40-something, it's nonsense. There are lots of really capable women who could do that. And I mean, furthermore, I have to say, and it's a slightly difficult argument this, but I mean, I find this whole attitude on Today of everyone has to be John Humphreys. I mean, Evan Davis was a really different voice when he started, and he was sort of really, was quite an interesting interviewer. He asked different questions. He was much more sort of voice of the people. Whereas I sort of feel that style, which is, look at me, I'm the presenter, I'm much more interesting, you can go too far. I mean, I'm not saying that only men do that. I'm not saying that women can't do it. But I do sort of think this attitude of there being one style of interview and you've all got to sort of be like Jeremy Paxman and John Humphreys is actually a mistake. And it means, I think it sort of actually is very bad for our political discourse and ahead of an election.
I think there's a variety of styles on Today, actually. I'm not sure. I think they've...
Not on Today, I don't
think. I don't think everyone's hectoring, you know, like Humphreys is in terms of the way they ask questions. But I do think, I mean, there is a weird culture in some parts of the BBC News, you know,
well, actually,
which is very male and very white, middle class. I know it's a familiar criticism, but there is a strange culture.
Well, this is the weird thing about replacing Edward Sturton with Justin Webb. You know,
ridiculous, really.
With the,
you know, Justin was a great broadcaster, well, great journalist.
That's not to say that he's not, but it's just, you know, when you're the editor of a programme like that, you just, when you're looking for a new presenter, you look for, well, what haven't we got?
Absolutely.
Who haven't we have got posh white people. Let's go and, you know, there's, but, you can, but just it's, reel off
it's,
names.
It's
Martha Carney, Sophie Lewis.
I mean, did you hear Sue McGregor and David Cameron this morning there? They obviously decided, oh,
it was Sarah Montague.
But, you know, they obviously do. They sort of thought, well, we'll bring someone in, we will have something different. And I'm not saying there's, you know, it's about style, actually, and having different voices, which is important.
And it's unforgivable. I mean, I do think it's unforgivable, especially BBC News, that it's a class thing as well. There are very few, there's still, even now, very few sort of northern accents or, you know, working class people.
He was appointed, 2 or 3 years ago now, I can't remember exactly, possibly longer, and that I would have thought that when you're appointed, that would be one of the first things that you start thinking about is the presenters and who are we, what kinds of voices are we missing, and do we need to be bringing people up? So he says there's no place for a rookie. Well, he could have started the search for people who could have been coming on now back then.
I think we're in total agreement.
We're all in agreagement about this. Fortunately, Film 2010 is clearly a place for a woman because they've appointed Claudia Winkleman to take over from Rossi. Very interestingly, it's divided opinion, hasn't it? Some people think it's a terrible, terrible appointment, mostly probably people who don't,
I think,
watch
people
Claudia
who are
Winkleman.
Sort of big Jonathan Ross fans who don't want anything other than Jonathan Ross and can't bear the thought that he's leaving.
But he was hardly some great big film expert either, was he?
But he had a fan. He had a huge fan
has
base.
A passion for film.
It is quite surprising. Claudia Winkleman was left field. What do you think?
I think it's a great appointment. I mean, you know, I think she'll be fun. And, you know, whenever I've seen her do things, I never really watched a lot of Jonathan Ross film show, so I'm sure there are lots of fans out there who will disagree.
You're not so keen.
I think she's good. I think she's very witty, very funny, very, very clever. You know, she's a very good broadcaster, and she's never really had a big chance, you know.
She's always been on
the digital channels
BBC Two.
Strictly Come Dancing spin-offs and so on and so on. So, no, absolutely, time is right for her to have a shot at the big time, I think.
Good luck to her. Indy and Lebedev onto Fleet Street. This is we're week one into the Lebedev-owned era of The Independent, and the paper's editor-in-chief, Simon Kellner, was on Steve Hewlett's media show on Radio 4 this week. They get all the big guests. Here's a clip.
A newspaper is only as good as its proprietor in this, you know, times have changed, and newspapers these days need proprietors who believe in them, who are prepared to invest in them, who think they've got a future. The question, I suppose, is Alexander Lebedev going to interfere in our newspaper? does he believe in the primacy of our journalism? Well, yes, he does believe in the primacy of our journalism. And no, he's not going to interfere in the editorial direction of the paper. And you only have to look at what he's done at Novaya Gazeta in Russia and the Evening Standard to show that he's got a pretty good track record. And also, I don't think you buy a paper called The Independent, like The Independent, unless you want it to remain independent.
So Simon Kellner clearly thinks and Lebedev is a good thing, but would he have said anything else? But we don't really believe that he's not going to interfere. He's clearly going to interfere in the commercial strategy, isn't he, James?
Well, I suppose you would say he's not. Yeah, well, it's not interfering, is it? It's up to him to set the commercial strategy, being as he owns the thing.
Yeah.
Absolutely right. But and I'm sure they'll, you know, the consensus seems to be they'll give it a few months and then consider to see if they can cut the price. Well, they could. Yeah, but I think that it's going to remain paid for a time, isn't it? And then if that doesn't work, if they can't improve circulation, they'll consider a more drastic model, i.e. taking it free. I mean, I think to be fair to Jordy Gregg and to the Lebedevs, there hasn't been a huge change in the standard of the standard journalism or the feel of it or the package overall, in my view.
It's a bit fluffy,
I mean, it's maybe, but it always had that society element and that, you know, and I think it's fundamentally changed.
I think that it's thinner. The news is thinner. James,
although I sort of agree with James that it is, but then lots of papers have taken that tack, haven't they? And the sort of, you know, increasing celebrity, increasing sense of society. They did that week of The Dispossessed, which actually I felt changed.
It was very good. Yeah.
I was completely with the people that said, you know, it's just becoming sort of Tatler, light. And, you know, there were slightly too many pictures of bright young things. But actually, I think that really addressed that and said, no, we can still campaign. Now, you know, it wasn't perfect, but lots of campaigns aren't. And I thought that was a real marker that they, although going down a certain track, because actually that's what lots of Londoners want, they are still prepared to do the campaigning thing as well.
Okay, good. A final one in this section. ITV, who last week axed the bill, are this week switching off Men and Motors. So it's a sad day for you, James.
Oh yeah, tragic. I didn't even realise it was still on, actually. Because, I mean, there's a far superior alternative, isn't there?
Called, what's that?
Well, Babe Station. That's obviously a joke. I don't actually mean that. In fact, it only came to my attention because Ofcom issued a few.
You're protesting too much,
But I used to have a girlfriend who did the voiceovers on Men and Motors, late night voiceovers.
I thought you were going
to say no, she wasn't on it. I know I'm causing
all sorts of trouble.
Sad to see the demise of Men and Motors.
But bonus points to Brian Tist, regular listener, for pointing out that all the other ITV channels that have bitten the dust, including ITV News, ITV Sport, ITV Select, Granada Talk TV, Granada Good Life Food and Wine, Granada Good Life Health and Beauty, Granada Good Life TV High Street, and the much-missed Granada Breeze. So it's a shame. All those channels are gone. There are details of all these stories, by the way, that we've been talking about on our blog at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk, where you'll also find a link to this.
First page, swine flu and road rage. Fine Maddie, foreign baddie, put him in a big cage. Bureaucratic red tape, Facebook gang rape. Gordon out, Dave in before the country caves in. Ian Huntley gets his own jacuzzi and a gym in jail. It's absolutely true because I read it in the Daily Mail.
Dan and Dan there with their excellent Daily Mail song. It's very good, Jane.
It made me laugh a lot.
Yeah, well, it's on. The video's even better. There's a link on. It's on the YouTube thing. Now, we were talking a few moments ago about the current Today programme editor making a bit of a fool of himself, and one of his predecessors has fallen in that department. He said something that he hopefully regrets. This is Rod Liddell we're talking about. He became this week the first journalist to be censured by the PCC for something he wrote on a blog, and in this case, it was on the Spectator website. Liddell claimed that the, quote, overwhelming majority, unquote, of violent crime in London was carried out by young African Caribbean men. Well, the Spectator editor and News of the World columnist Fraser Nelson was in the Guardian's offices, as it happened, this week. We discussed the lessons to be learned from Rod's latest indiscretion, but I began by asking Fraser what it felt like being one of the most prominent journalists of the right in the run-up to an election the Tories are contriving to lose.
It feels rather strange to be described as a prominent journalist of the right, but I guess it's like saying you're the tallest mountain in the Netherlands, really. These are not good times for conservative supporters, because we have seen our critique of Labour come true in every regard. There's been fiscal collapse beyond the forecasts of even the most pessimistic of us. But we have not seen the electorate turn to the Conservatives in the way that they have emphatically turned away from the Labour Party. This is a source of worry to any Conservative who's banging on doorsteps right now, who is getting them to say, yes, they hate Gordon Brown, but what's David Cameron going to do about it? We're not really sure. Now, I can give you lots of reasons why I think a Conservative government would be a lot better than a Labour one, but I'll have to concede that the average voter is not aware of them.
You were down at the TV debate, the Channel 4 TV debate this week. What did you make of that, and how do you think that will inform the rest of the campaign?
I thought the debate was rather dull because everybody was playing defensively. It struck me watching it how it could well be that the objective for every single politician going in there is to walk away having not made a huge big clangor. Because we all know if you say a very clever word or a phrase, it might get repeated once or twice in the news. If you make a huge mistake, it will haunt you for the rest of the campaign. So I hope that the leaders' debates between David Cameron and Gordon Brown and Nick Clegg will be a little more spunky. You know, we want to have some zest.
There's the 70 rules or whatever. They're going to be even less spunky, aren't they?
It's very depressing. I imagine that the amount of cups of teas being made 20 minutes into that debate will surge throughout the nation if it is as boring as that. Which is a shame, because in our Prime Minister's Question Time, we have, as a country, a great method to see two guys going at it against each other. If the political debates are pale imitations of that, I really do think voters are going to feel shortchanged. But those who want to be informed rather than just see it as a piece of political panto might be grateful for it. I mean, a lot of people, I've heard anyway, said that they were quietly impressed by George Osborne because he wasn't the complete fool he'd been described as being in the media. But you could say that he killed the calumnies, he managed to combat his negatives. It's not a bad result. I can't say he walked away there from a triumph, but I do think it was a net positive for him. It would have won more voters around for him, and that is the objective of the whole thing.
What kind of election campaign is this going to be in the media? Is it going to be all about the TV debates? Is it going to be all about the internet? What's your sense?
I don't think it's going to be as much about internet dominated as the last two American presidential campaigns are being, simply because I don't think we've got the critical mass of talent on the internet as opposed to print. I still think the overwhelming majority of our talent in the media industry lies in the dead tree press. So I think when the papers come out every morning, you're going to be reading then what will move forward the debate. Now, it could well be that the papers don't do it that way, and that The Guardian asks its political journalists to blog what they see and think and hear immediately. If so, it will be an internet debate, but I rather suspect that until we find ways of monetizing the internet, the political journalists will be under pressure to keep their best dope for the pages of the paper.
Talking about the internet, you're the editor that's presiding over the rather ignominious situation, and you're the first person to be censured by the PCC for running a blog that had to be apologised for. How do you feel about that?
This is new territory for everybody, for the PCC, and for those of us who host individual blogs. Normally, as an editor, if you publish somebody's article, you would edit it, you would go to them with any queries. We do not have any editorial control over Rod Little's blog, Melanie Phillips' blog, the author's blog, which we host, but we do publish them and as a result, I am ultimately responsible for the accuracy of those blogs and for any legal disputes arising out of them. It's up to us to make sure that we correct any mistakes, and we were happy to abide by the PCC ruling.
So do you think it means that you will need to exert a bit more editorial control?
I think that those who blog for us will realise, in a way perhaps they didn't before, that they are subject to the same standards of scrutiny as they are on the printed press. Roy Greenslade made this comment on his delighted blog the other day. He couldn't believe his luck when Rod Little was done by the PCC. But I do agree with his conclusion that the net result of this will be to persuade anybody who blogs that they need to follow the same standards as they would if they were writing for a book or a newspaper.
You got the editorship of The Spectator about 6 months ago. Was that as much of a surprise to you as it was the rest of us?
it was a surprise. I was on holiday in Sweden at the time, and it was a rather wonderful surprise to be calling my friends from this weird island in the middle of the Baltic Sea. But, you know, journalism is a great career full of the unpredictable, and I'm delighted to have been so favoured.
Fraser Nelson there, with an extremely posh Scottish accent. So that's what if you're posh and Scottish, that's what you sound like.
I thought they sounded like you.
I mean, no, I have lost my Scottish accent. I can put it back on again now and again. He's a very interesting chap, isn't he? We like Fraser Nelson, even though he's a Tory right-winger.
Well, he was incredibly entertaining.
Yes,
He was incredibly entertaining in that in conference. He's incredibly confident, obviously very sharp. But I think the reason he was entertaining and charming in that room is that he judged the audience, which is that we're lots of journalists. And, you know, he talked about the election and the fact that the Tories weren't doing so well as good for business.
Yes.
Which is fantastic. You know, that's what we all like to hear. None of us really want to be tribal. We just want good stories,
yes,
don't we?
No, he was quite, yes. Yeah, he said lots of other interesting things. And it was interesting ruling, that the PCC handed down. As we were hearing there, I think Fraser is a bit sort of inconsistent in it, in that he says, "Oh, they're just blogs, and you know, and I don't have that much editorial control over it." But now you do have to have editorial control over it, don't you?
Yeah, I think it's a common sense approach, isn't it? When you know that you've got someone like Rod Liddell on your staff, then you just take it. Well, you say, "Are you writing anything particularly contentious this week?" Well, I know he is most weeks, and then you demand to see the copy.
1 o'clock on a Sunday morning.
It was written.
If you're going to let Rodley Dore, really many of your columnists
self-publish,
then you've really. And I mean, I was really sorry to.
That's not a defence. I mean, basically, isn't it? It's not a defence, is it?
All right. Well, listen. There's plenty. We do plenty of politics too at the Guardian, of course, and you can keep up to date with all things election 2010 at guardian.co.uk/politics. Now, time is almost up, but before we go, Jane and James, tell me something you've learnt this week. Jane, you've been practising because I know your performance in this particular segment. You haven't. I'm not saying anything, but you feel that you haven't been up to scratch.
I hate this bit.
Yeah. So you've brought in something that you've prepared.
Well, sort of.
Well,
just from Brookie's
that.
Leaving party. Well,
This is why we're all standing slightly under the weather today. We were at Stephen Brooks' leaving do last night, last night at time of podding, and it was quite an affair.
It was quite an affair with a Stephen Brook quiz.
which I hosted, but I was merely hosting. He'd written all the questions.
It's got a limited appeal, I think, outside that room.
It probably did, yes. Anyway,
the answer to the first question was who had been encouraged into journalism by something written by her grandmother. And it was Rebecca Brooks, which I hadn't read.
Yes, she had a column about poetry in her local paper.
Yeah.
And that's why Rebecca Brooks got journalism.
Something great. I learnt this week.
Top fact.
Obviously, as I came first, without any gerrymandering whatsoever, I knew the answers to the rest of the questions.
It was because you all cheated. this team, which we gave prizes to, that Jane Martinson was part of, and Wayne Garvey from the BBC, and Tom Kelly from the Daily Mirror Matt Kelly. Not Tom Kelly, he's a Downing Street press officer, wasn't he? they cheated because they mark their own paper, and so they just mark
Wayne Garvey
answers right.
That's 11, on the record.
11 out of 15 they got. James, what's your story?
I wasn't there. It's not fair because I wasn't there last night. Right. I've been in bed all week with the flu and dealing with the Mail on Sunday. I learned that the Mail on Sunday are a fairly vicious lot, but then I knew that already, didn't I?
Yes.
So I was going to say, I'm not sure if I can say this, the lovely Maggie Brown learned last week.
National treasure.
Who's an extraordinarily charming and brilliant journalist, and who did go to Stephen's quiz, I know, last night, and remarked at one stage, asked someone sitting next to her if Stephen was gay,
yes.
Which I thought was
it's very endearing.
Beautiful.
Maggie,
endearing,
yeah. She's very well. She's she is very well observed. Maggie usually
doesn't miss much.
She doesn't miss much, but that is one thing she did miss. Yeah. Anyway, this is what I've learned. I've learned that Nikki Campbell should never again be allowed to go near the words countryside and hunting. Listen to this.
Yes.
Thanks, Bob. Listening to that, Tim Bonner from the Countryside Alliance. Defence, an organisation which is, of course, pro-hunting. Have you ever known a law so openly broken?
It's not the first time he's done that.
It's not the first time he's got form in that. He just...
No, not using that word before. Not
yes,
in
yes,
that
yes,
way.
Yes.
No.
And when talking about hunts, he shouldn't be allowed to do stories about...
God knows what would happen if he actually went hunting.
I know. Anyway, there we are. Thank you very much to Nikki Campbell and to James Robinson, and happy holidays to Jane Martinson. Thank you. You'll find links to the to everything we've discussed this week on our blog at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk, and there's all the usual Twitter and Facebookery too. Media Talk is produced by Ben Green. I'm Matt Wells. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.